From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Jose.
Oakland.
Antioch.
Half Moon Bay.
Yeah, same here, Half Moon Bay.
Coming up, people unite to win their battle against personal debt.
Stand up if you have a car loan. Keep standing. Stand up if you have a mortgage. Stand up if you have medical debt, medical bills that you can't pay.
The struggle to stay in the black. Then another kind of struggle, living with multiple sclerosis.
Today, my feet are fine, but I notice that my face is twitching in this really weird way that you probably already noticed. Like,
And have you ever written something and then regretted it? We sure have.
What is wrong with us today? Are we all too tired to play?
Ah, regretterature. That's today on Cross Currents. Earlier today, about 40 people with banners, flyers, and horns gathered in front of Wells Fargo headquarters in downtown San Francisco to protest the bank's continuing foreclosures. One of the demonstrators, Tanya Dennis, said she'd been fighting an illness for a year and a half, and as a result, she couldn't make her mortgage payments.
I'm really fighting for my mother's home. We were together in this, and we were working on a modification. And my mother died, and they said no more modification offer, move out or pay $1.2 million.
Wells Fargo stole my home on January 10th of this year illegally.
In San Francisco and across the country, Americans are struggling to keep their homes. Part of what makes it hard is that many are also battling personal debt. Check out these numbers. As of this month, average credit card debt is $15,204. And average student loan debt, $33,005. These debts can have long-term consequences. They're financially draining, personally stressful, and can dog families even after someone dies. So, as bank bailouts in recent years gave birth to Occupy Wall Street, the growing personal debt crisis is spurring a new movement. KALW's Jen Chien went to a recent gathering and brings back this story.
When I walk into the East Side Arts Alliance in East Oakland, it's clear that this is a special kind of conference. At the welcome table, I'm offered a name tag sticker. You know, the kind that usually says, "Hello, my name is." But these say, "Hello, my debt is."
Hello, my debt is $122,000.
$71,000 from student loans and from an accident I was in last year, medical debt as well.
Got a combination of student debt, tax debt, medical debt, which includes fixing my teeth.
$35,000-$40,000 averaging, which is more than I make in a year. So,
Bill Bowers, Christy Keller, Brad DeLange, and Renee Soto are among the 70 or so people here for something called a debtors' assembly. It's organized by Strike Debt Bay Area, the local chapter of a larger movement that came out of Occupy Wall Street.
There were a lot of issues that were coming together in Occupy that seemed separate.
Hannah Appel is one of the main organizers.
There were groups organizing around student debt. There were, you know, the health care for the 99%. Even though they seemed separate, the effect of all of these is the same. The effect is debt.
One reason it's been hard to unite around this issue is because people often feel ashamed and isolated when it comes to their debt, even though it's something that most people have in common.
So stand up if you have credit card debt. Keep your eyes closed. Keep them closed. Keep them closed.
To make this point, the Oakland Debtors Assembly starts with an exercise.
Stand up if you have medical debt, medical bills that you can't pay.
By the time the exercise is over, almost every single person in the room is on their feet.
Now open your eyes and take a look around. So obviously we are not alone. All of us feel this pain of this debt. We are not alone by ourselves, and we are not alone to these banks. Have a seat.
Everyone sits back down, and then there's a kind of big picture presentation to explain different systems of debt and debt statistics from around the country.
You've got consumer debt going way up, and the only thing that's going down is our wages.
The presenter is Claire Haas. She's a staff organizer with ACE, the Association of Californians for Community Empowerment. She got involved with Strike Debt through her work helping people facing foreclosure. And even though her organization focuses on individuals, she says if you go up the financial food chain, you see how debt can cripple entire communities.
We see cuts to schools, to libraries, to public transit, to services that people depend on day in and day out. But at the same time, we see millions of dollars every year being paid out to Wall Street by our city governments. They've given them bad deals. And we shouldn't even be talking about cutting another penny from our communities until we actually get the money back that the bank stole from us.
When Haas talks about banks stealing and giving bad deals, she has specific examples in mind. Like when GE, Wells Fargo, and JP Morgan Chase admitted illegal activities by their employees after being sued by the federal government. They paid billions of dollars in restitution and penalties. And there's a growing number of these cases as we try to figure out what or who caused the financial crisis. The problem, Haas says, is that these cases can get pretty confusing.
We talk about LIBOR, we talk about interest rate swaps, letters of credit, etc. And most of us say, I have no idea what that is.
But she says it's not necessary to know the finer details of the LIBOR scandal, for example, to understand how it impacts regular people.
You put a lion and a boy together and you get a LIBOR. But that's not really what it is.
So with some visual aids, Haas explains that LIBOR is actually an acronym for the London Interbank Offering Rate.
And so basically what happens is every day the bankers in London, they get together and they decide the interest rate they're going to trade with each other at. And so there's $800 trillion that are affected by this rate across the world.
That $800 trillion includes a whole range of financial products and services, like mortgages, pensions, student loans, car loans, and credit cards.
And the way that it worked is... they would get together in this meeting to determine the interest rate, and they would determine it based on how they were going to make the most money. And what was found out is that they cheated.
This means that millions of people were paying more interest than they should have. Even some city governments were earning less from their investments, which means having less money to spend on things like schools, police, and hospitals.
This is unprecedented. This is not like any of the other kinds of debt stuff because they've admitted that they were wrong. They've admitted that they cheated. They broke the law. What they did is illegal. And we can sue them for it.
First, I think the idea behind Strike Debt is just empowerment.
Organizer Hannah Appel says that once people are armed with this kind of knowledge, they can take action.
We can renegotiate interest rates. We can default en masse on our debts.
And while the idea of mass defaulting on debts may strike some people as irresponsible, Appel says it's something that banks themselves are already doing.
Banks know that they don't have to pay their debts, right? There's been this thing where they know that they're going to get bailed out, or banks know that they can renege on contracts or renegotiate interest rates. But we as citizens have not sort of taken that power into our own hands or realized that it can be ours.
So the Strike Debt movement wants to make that happen. Last year, the New York chapter came up with a creative strategy to erase people's debt. They called it the Rolling Jubilee. Basically, the organization became a debt collector. Debt collectors buy unpaid or distressed debt at a big discount and then try to make a profit by going after the original amount.
The Rolling Jubilee raised money to buy people's distressed medical debt for pennies on the dollar.
But instead of collecting on that debt, they forgave it. Strike Debt recently announced that it's abolished over $1 million worth of medical debt belonging to about 1,000 people chosen at random.
I think debt, like any other contract, needs to be entered into at a level of fairness.
That's another organizer. We'll call him Mike Smith. He didn't want to give his real name because he works for one of the big banks. He says the financial system that he's a part of isn't fair when it comes to debt. He has a good credit score. But he says,
I could just as easily be somebody who's a victim of predatory lending, someone who has had to use payday lending, some of these more sort of parasitic lending practices.
Smith says he makes a good living, but even he's not immune to financial trouble. He's paying off a mortgage, student loans, credit card debt, and...
Recently, my wife, has had some health setbacks, which has both reduced our income and increased our medical expense, and it makes things very precarious for us.
At the end of the debtors' assembly, people break out into smaller groups. Like Smith, they share stories that sound like they could happen to anybody. Getting into a car wreck with no insurance, graduating from college with a student loan and no job, or owing more on a house than what it's worth.
And so $1,000 of the payment every month goes just to interest, and the other $400 is the principal. And you know, if it weren't that way, then you know, my life would be totally different.
When everyone walked into the room a few hours ago, they may have felt their debt issues were insurmountable. But by the end, I see a lot of smiles and people listening intently to each other's stories. And though their problems may not all be solved today, at least they know they're not alone. In East Oakland, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
What solutions do you have for people in debt? Leave your tips to live by on our feedback line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and we might get your call on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Living with debt can be burdensome and can sometimes feel like living with a chronic illness. You hope that someone someday will find a cure for it, but in the meantime, you just manage. Melanie Rowan is a lawyer. In her 20s, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, MS. In this interview with her friend Christina Wirtz, Rowan describes living with the disease. This is San Francisco StoryCorps.
It happened for like 5 seconds before this, like at a previous time, and I'd ignored it. But then I woke up one morning and I looked up at the ceiling, and the ceiling was spinning in that way, if you're very drunk, where things spin and then they resolve and then they spin and then they resolve. And you can never quite get things to stay still, even though they never really go all the way around. They're just moving. And I thought, I'm not drunk right now, yet the ceiling is moving. Like, maybe I've got a problem here. So that was vertigo. And it was, things were like that for a few days, and I felt really like lightheaded and weird, like I was in a bubble. It was pretty strange. So I took a few days, then I went to the neurologist. I like to sit and think about my symptoms before I see anyone about them. And that made me officially a person with MS, which actually made me able to get medicated for MS, which was a good thing. And you have to keep your friends and family informed if they're going to be able to understand what's going on with you. But that can be exhausting to be like, today my feet are fine, but I notice that my face is twitching in this really weird way that you probably already noticed. Like,
or your friends and family have to keep you informed.
Right.
What's going
or
on.
Today I'm having a hard time concentrating or listening to what you're saying or remembering anything that's going on. It affects me actually pretty much every day in my professional life. I would say it's difficult not to be in a, particularly in a professional environment where I don't necessarily want people to know that I'm struggling. I've always been like a big nerd and book person and a person who used my memory and my ability to take tests and things like that to get through life, and thought of myself as being good at those things, and I was good because I was good at those things. Mm-hmm. I don't want to think that I'm good anymore because I'm good at certain things. I want to think mm-hmm. that I'm good because I'm a kind person, because I'm generous, because I'm a good friend, like things like that, not because I can achieve certain things or manage certain types of tasks. So yeah, I've kind of tried to reformulate my whole self-esteem to think about, like, what's really important about people and what do I value in other people? I always was a big believer in making your own luck, and I felt like if I wanted something, if I had the right mindset about it, I could make it happen within reason.
Melanie Rowan spoke to her friend Christina Wirtz inside the StoryCorps booth at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. You too can interview a loved one. We'll show you how at kalw.org. ¶¶ Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. One way some people deal with challenges like chronic illness is to put pen to paper and write about it. Writing is soothing. Some say it's healing. Well, some writing is. Some other writing? Well, not so much. But bad writing is part of every writer's history. You know, that forced poem from the seventh grade, that corny love letter from college. You remember those, right? You're not alone. In fact, you're in very good company. This Thursday, members of the esteemed San Francisco Writers Grotto will stand up and read their worst writing in front of an audience. It's part of the annual Litquake Festival, and it's called Regretterature. KALW's Martina Castro went to last year's show and did some thinking about her own creative process. Here's Martina.
It's Wednesday night, and I'm at the Verdi Club in San Francisco. The show is sold out to a crowd of hipsters and glittering literati. I'm surrounded by high-pitched laughter and colorful cocktails. I feel like these people are somebody. Oh, shh, it's starting.
Guppy love. And why not guppies?
Oh, God. This is best-selling author Mary Roach. The guppies are from a column she wrote in her first job as a public information specialist at the SPCA.
And I'm going to skip ahead here to the last line because I have 600 words and I needed to wind it up fast and I didn't really know how to do it. And so here's what I wrote. So let's hear it for guppies. Thanks.
This is a piece of regretriture. Part literature, part stomach-sickening, face-wincing, skin-crawling regret. The kind of writing that, at a minimum, you should keep tucked away in your closet. That's where I keep mine. But it's better left deep under the house, collecting mold. Taking it out, reading it? Unthinkable. But that's exactly what 10 writers are doing in front of hundreds of people. Best-selling, reputable writers whose work you can read in publications like McSweeney's, Mother Jones, and the New York Times. Like Jeff Greenwald, who reads from his first book of poetry.
I realized there is no radio. The seals are singing to the vanishing evening, barking through a pain I could never understand.
And it gets worse.
The inscription inside the book, which I saw after I picked this book up at Green Apple in the late 1980s, and I'm going to read the inscription to you. I didn't make this up. To Mom and Dad, with all my love, Jeff Greenwald.
Yes, you heard right. His own parents couldn't bear to keep his book, so they sold it.
Man will chop. Man will kill. He'll leave no trees left standing still.
The agony goes on. Award-winning journalist Todd Oppenheimer reads from a poetry contest entry. And Katie Crouch reads from her Hello Kitty diary.
I'm almost 9. I have red hair and would be a good friend, if I must say so myself.
Melodrama oozes from personal journals like Julia Scott's.
It's even enough to know that I am living in the same lifetime as he, let alone being in the same room.
Yep, this is truly embarrassing stuff. But the writers, they look relaxed, almost relieved to get a chance to read it out loud and laugh along with the audience at their former, less talented selves, almost as if to confess. But Julia Scott says she wasn't relieved until she left the stage, precisely because those words used to be so meaningful.
Parenthetical thoughts and kind of convoluted thinking and you know, things that were deeply melodramatic. And you sort of don't know how it's going to come out until you say it. And you don't know whether the crowd is going to go along with you and find what you wrote so earnestly at age 20 hilarious.
But they did. People laughed until their sides hurt, and so did the writers, like Jeff Greenwald. He says in his line of work, you have to be able to laugh at yourself and be comfortable with humiliation.
You don't hear back from editors,
You know, when you're lucky enough to get a rejection, it's always a disappointment. You write something that you think is wonderful, and then you hear back, well, this is great, but take all the good parts out. So it's sort of, you know, those of us who do this kind of work have kind of agreed to continually live that life. We must be getting something from it.
And the readers get something, too.
It's only when we sort of are really vulnerable that we're most accessible.
So all of this has me thinking about my writing. I write for radio. I wrote this very story you're hearing right now. And I could just end it right here. But I can see how you might think it's a little unfair of me to display other writers' worst work without sharing a little bit of my own. So I dug around and found a piece of my own regretriture, circa 1996. This is from my first book of poetry, and I use the term book lightly here. But anyway, here's a poem from my melodramatic days of age 14. Okay, here we go. It's titled Mortality. What is wrong with us today? Are we all too tired to play? Don't you feel? Don't you care? Do you understand? Do you dare? People die left and right, all through the day and all through the night. Do you think this can't happen to you? That tomorrow your life cannot be through? Well, it happens to everyone someday. We are all slowly but surely passing away. One day, everyone must die. Yet, most don't have a chance to say bye. Just remember how no one lives forever. Maybe then, your life, you can learn to treasure. Yours in regretriture, and just a little bit of regret. I'm Martina Castro for Cross Currents.
Regretterature 2013 happens this Thursday night at the Swedish American Hall in San Francisco. If you go, come back and tell us how it was. Post on our Facebook page at KALW. That's also where you can post some of your regretterature. Share if you dare. That's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Christina Loring, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, RJ Sloan, and Eva Sansin. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. They're online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. With a severely under-resourced police force and increased crime, how are Oakland residents protecting themselves?
When eyes are on the street and the people doing the crime know that, they tend not to be as obvious and not to be as frequent.
Neighbors on the Lookout, that's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. If marching bands are all you imagine when you think of college percussion ensembles, you're in for a surprise when you hear the San Francisco State Percussion Ensemble. They perform next Monday in the Creative Arts Building at San Francisco State. Music starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. ¶¶